This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. And today is a day of mourning for the 150 victims of Germanwings Flight 9525. Mourners gathered alongside German President Joachim Gauck in the German city of Haltern today. That comes to us from German television RTL. As new information emerges about the final moments before Germanwings Flight 9525 is believed to have been deliberately crashed into the French Alps. In response, airlines around the world are reevaluating their cockpit policies. Yesterday, Canadian officials announced a revised policy to require two people in the cockpit at all times. Now, this is a policy that's been in place in the United States for many years, and now four European airlines are doing the same. We're also learning more about the co-pilot, Andreas Lubitz. French prosecutors say he had a medical condition that he hid from his employer, that's Germanwings. German investigators said they did not find any kind of suicide note in Lubitz's home, but they did find a torn-up doctor's note allowing him time off work because of an illness. At the same time, there are reports in German media that Lubitz suffered from depression. Jeff Wise is the author of the Kindle single The Plane That Wasn't There, Why We Haven't Found MH370. He joins me in the studio now. Jeff, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Jeff, you're a pilot, and I want to get your perspective as a pilot here. What questions do you still have about how this crash happened?
Almost every question I still have. It's a very strange case. There have been cases in the past in which pilots fly their plane into the ground, killing themselves and everyone aboard, but they are very, very rare, and they are shrouded in mystery because very rarely do they leave pilot's notes. Very rarely do you hear on the audio recording from the cockpit voice recorder an explanation or, you know, an exclamation of why they're doing this. And so the few cases that it has happened, we don't really know why it happened. There's often talk of marital discord or financial troubles, but it's hard to go from, you know, depression, stress to this really unbelievable act of killing yourself and, you know, over 100 people.
Right. And mass murder. Well, in a way, it's not different than what a bus driver could do if they chose, or somebody driving a car could deliberately crash it.
That's true.
In a way, it's not different from that. It's just on a grander scale.
Right. I mean, you could draw a line between something like this and the different kinds of murder, suicide that take place with disturbing frequency in society. People walking into a movie theater with an automatic weapon, for instance. But I would, you know, another answer to your question is pilots are different kinds of people. I'm a recreational pilot. I can't claim to be one of these guys, commercial pilots who spent so many thousands of hours in the air. In this case, he was a fairly low-time pilot, just about 600 hours. But still, someone who had dedicated his life to the love of flying. These are people who are self-motivated, disciplined, who are doing something that a lot of people are scared to fly at all. These people are doing it day in and day out. And so I don't think you can liken it really to a disgruntled post office employee, for instance.
Right. A lot of it is so hard to process because the other imperative of pilots, especially commercial pilots, of course, is safety and shepherding their passengers safely to their destination. And that's why this is so very hard, among other reasons, for a lot of people to process. Let me ask you about regulations and rules. Is it true that this basically could not have happened on a U.S. airline because of the two people in the cockpit policy?
To that, I would say absolutely not. That is not the case. There have been cases in which people have flown their plane into the ground in the presence of other people in the cockpit. And so I don't think this rule is neither necessary or adequate, frankly, because this is such a black swan type of event, so incredibly rare. This kind of thing has never happened in a North American or European carrier before. And even if you look at the entire world, it's very rare. And so I don't feel like it's a burning issue that we have to address. I think something like this happens, it becomes suddenly in people's consciousness for the first time, and people feel this imperative. We need to do something about it.
You're suggesting that there aren't regulatory changes that could prevent this kind of thing from happening. It's so rare and so dependent on one person's will to cause a catastrophic event that there's really no way to have a failsafe.
Well, what I find really troubling is this idea, all of us, which is very new, I think, in our culture, this idea that pilots are now not to be trusted, that they are people upon which we must look with suspicion, and we have to figure out how we can guard against the malicious intent of pilots. The reality is that trust in pilots is the bedrock of the entire aviation system. The pilots are the ultimate authority. And if we don't trust the ultimate authority, we really don't trust the system itself. So I think we need to perhaps think a little bit more carefully before we run down this road of how can we police the pilots.
Let's talk about the cockpit for a second, though. Two people in the cockpit seems like it might make it harder. If you wanted to sabotage a flight, you'd have another person there trying to stop you. In the actual flying of a plane, does that potentially help prevent a catastrophe?
Yes. I mean, I can definitely see that how that point could be made. But I think we have to remember how incredibly vanishingly rare this potential that we're trying to prevent really is. And so, you know, if it's one in 100 million versus one in 50 million, I think that's what we're kind of looking at. So I don't think we should take comfort in feeling that we've solved the problem.
At the same time, you know, it's understandable, predictable that drastic reactions would be taken, that people want to do something.
Yes.
That flight MH370, which you've written about, was covered exhaustively and ad nauseum for months when that plane disappeared by cable news. And the media environment seems to be maybe one of the things that's changed. Maybe aviation safety hasn't changed all that much.
Oh, absolutely. I think MH370 has radically changed the way we think about aviation. And I think it's prepared us to become very anxious about airplane incidents that before might have gotten a day or two of coverage. But now, I mean, I went on air for 2 weeks or something after the AirAsia crash in December, and that turned out not to be that strange of a crash. But I think what we're worried about are these kind of mysterious, baffling cases that are even more troubling than a normal plane crash because they seem to resist explanation.
And they make us have the desire and the need to react. Investigations are going on and questions still swirling around the crash of Germanwings Flight 9525 in the mountains of France. Jeff Wise is the author of the Kindle single, The Plane That Wasn't There, Why We Haven't Found MH370. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.